Welcome to Physique Star Radio, brought to you by Myotropics and Dr. Scott Connolly. Here are your hosts, Ian Lauer and Vince Andrich.
Welcome to Physique Star Radio. We're your hosts. I'm Ian Lauer with Vince Andrich, and we're here today. Welcome to the show.
Well, how's it going, Ian? How you doing?
Oh, having a great day, running around doing the errands, per usual. Yourself?
Oh, well, it was a overly busy Monday because of the weekend. Was out at the Gold Coast Muscle Classic down in San Diego.
Yeah, how was it?
It was good. For the first show of the year, I mean, talking to the promoter, John Lindsay, he was very pleased with the turnout.
Excellent. Now, how many physique shows have you actually had a chance to sit in and watch?
You know, I've been at several shows, but I have never, except this last weekend, never sat in the audience and actually did an evaluation to see kind of what the judges are looking for and process it myself.
And what was your, I guess, take home on that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it follows suit with bodybuilding and with respect to it's relative, you know, depending on who's there that day, you know, your lines could be really, really good, or you can look a little bit too big in certain areas, especially in the physique, because they're not really necessarily looking for the biggest guy, obviously. You know, I had a couple of friends that there's their first physique show, and they were actually seemed to be a little too big, and they're not really big. They're just right on the bubble. But they had a couple kind of surfer looking guys in their class. So, and it made them appear bigger than they actually were. So I guess my point is relative.
It is relative. If you're standing next to a broom, you're going to look a bit bulbous. Unfortunately, if you have some extra muscle on and you're next to, you know, someone that's really scrawny, you are going to look a little large. But that's something you hear time and time again from the judges. It comes down to who shows up that day.
Right, and on the extremes, especially for physique, that's probably not where you want to be.
Right. Yeah, if you're super skinny or if you're extremely muscular, as they say, you'll be marked down for that. So it seems to be finding the sweet spot. Unfortunately, going into a show, you never really know where that sweet spot's going to be. And I can't remember which judge I was talking to or who it was at the time, but they basically said if you look at the array of bodies as a bell curve, and you take the middle, you want to be just a little to the right. You want to be a little bit bigger, a little bit harder, and, you know, with that, a good smile and good stage presence, but not too extreme.
No, that's a good point. And the other thing that I noticed is there was only 10 bodybuilders in the whole, out of 110 competitors, only 10 bodybuilders in the whole deal, every weight class.
Wow.
There was a guy who wanted to enter the super heavies because there was no one there. He just wanted to enter and just walk out and do a couple poses and take his trophy. But
I'm all about collecting a couple trophies here and there, but to enter into a class just to get a trophy is not really.
it was obviously a joke, but he was like, should I shave or not?
And we were all laughing. Vince, why didn't you call me? I could have put my tighties on and driven down.
Look, you know, I didn't weigh enough. Otherwise, I would have done it. No.
No, but that is that's amazing. About how many physique guys were there?
I'm going to say over 40.
So you had to take your shoes off to count then?
I did.
So we had roughly 40 physique guys and only 10 bodybuilders. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I could be wrong on the exact numbers, but I can tell you what, the crowd... beyond the competitors, it was full of physique athletes watching and just wanting, you know, supporting their friends that were entering and just to be in the mix. And the other interesting thing is when you see bodybuilders now, and I had many guys come up to me who are bodybuilders and or ex-bodybuilders, it just looks funnier now. I mean, more out of place now because you have guys that have a good physique, they do physique shows, and you're like, okay, that's a really nice physique. And then you see a bodybuilder, you know he's got a great body. But because it's all relative, you're like, whoa, that guy looks like he's kind of from outer space because he's got so much muscle.
Right.
And so I think you're starting to see that now. I mean, even you know, guys that have been involved in it a long time are like, you just didn't really know how your judgment is skewed. Like you said, it's a bell curve. You know, you're judging against all guys that are super muscular. Now you've got guys that really look pleasing and are still almost bodybuilders. And the difference is really striking.
Well, when you see, yeah, the more natural looking lines that go on a physique competitor versus a bodybuilder, yeah, and especially like you say, when you start seeing the large numbers, the droves of physique competitors are showing up, and then next to them you have 10 bodybuilders, yeah, you start to your eye will shift to the physique body. You just start to expect that more so than a bodybuilder, even at what traditionally is a bodybuilding show.
Yeah, well, I had a very, very good friend who's he's still competing for, you know, his pro card. And he's like, man, it seems odd to see bodybuilders, doesn't it? You know, you see him walking around and you're like, that just seems odd now. But
well, we're going to have a huge boom this year. I mean, a lot of guys sat out the first year that were considering physique. And then what you're also seeing now is a lot of the bodybuilders are jumping ship and coming to physique. I actually was speaking with one the other day at the gym. And I don't know if I told you this or we talked about this on another show, but it was really interesting because, of course, guys are going to talk trash about physique. Normally, it's coming from the bodybuilding community. And, you know, he said, you know, everybody's just saying how I don't remember the exact words, but something like wimpy physique guys are. And I just said, hold on a second. When you say everybody, I said, first off, you're a bodybuilder, right? He goes, yes. But he's coming over to physique. And I said, well, you're a bodybuilder. And when you say everybody, what is your frame of reference? I'm like, who are you talking to and who's saying that? Well, they're bodybuilders. I said, exactly. Bodybuilders make up a very small percentage of the nation. So when you look at the nation as a whole and the people that really are going to be watching physique, it's wildly popular in comparison, and it's really taking off as a result.
That's good point. I mean, it's all about your worldview. You know, you start hanging out with a bunch of bodybuilders, then your perception is skewed. And that's a, you know, much respect for anybody who wants to compete as a bodybuilder.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think at the end of the day, all of us are bodybuilders.
Precisely.
It's just where are you going to wind up being and feel comfortable competing if that's what you want to do. So, yeah, it's, I think even some of the bodybuilders are looking at the attention the physique guys are getting and going, maybe I might want to try that.
Well, I think they're seeing that it's more marketable, for sure, if they're looking to land these magazines, which, speaking of magazines, our guest today is going to be Max Wettstein, who's landed, I can't even tell you how many different covers. So we're going to bring him in later to talk about getting magazine covers and getting into different infomercials and whatnot. But the attention that the physique guys are getting in comparison to like an old school bodybuilder, it's pretty magnificent.
Well, yeah. I mean, it, you know, over the years, there's been some bodybuilding guys that got, you know, commercials that were more high level. I think Tom Terwilliger actually got a UPS or a FedEx commercial years ago. It was like a big deal, but you don't see that much.
No, I mean, don't get me wrong. You definitely do see guys landing things. I know Jerome Ferguson has had a great year, 2011, when it comes to different commercials or print ads and things like that. There are those jobs out there. However, the percentage of the number of those jobs available is very small, and you really have to fit that niche. So you have to be the best in that very small category in comparison to the range that physique guys have.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, you know, the guys on, you know, get on camera, you know this, you're going to look bigger anyway. So, you know, getting a gig on the old Married with Children or one of these Modern Family or something, you know,
I'm sorry, but did you just say Married with Children, trying to get a gig on Married with Children?
I did. That's how long it's been since a bodybuilder actually got a gig like that. Well, yeah, I mean, I think we talked about this offline one time, and it was, you know, And that's the reason that show comes to mind, is there's a bunch of ex-Chippendale guys and Richard Bros and some of these guys that used to be in the magazines, Muscle and Fitness and whatnot, that were bodybuilders, but they were smaller. And they did get those gigs.
Oh, they were they running around wearing no ma'am shirts or with their cutoffs?
I'm not sure. They're probably wearing cutoff Levi's like you were wearing the other day in the gym.
Oh, yeah. Well, those things are nice. Really hiked up, too. You know, I had them frayed specially for my appearance at Gold's.
That's nice.
Did you notice my denim vest that went with them?
Well, the yellow leotards underneath is a nice touch, too. I like that.
Well, that's only for when I'm doing certain movements, but but I'm glad it didn't go unnoticed.
Oh, man.
Well, but in all seriousness, you know, I do like bringing my fanny back.
You still have a fanny pack, huh?
No, I really didn't. Actually, when I had a fanny pack, that was, oh my goodness, that was a long time ago. But I do see guys carrying the fanny pack. I guess I should ask, what is your official stance on the fanny pack at the gym?
It's a no-go, man. It's a no-go.
Why are the... I'm sorry, please continue.
Well, I was going to say, I thought I had seen the last of it, but I saw a couple guys at this show this weekend saddle up, man. They saddled up with the fanny pack, and I didn't have the nerve to say anything. Like, that might not work anymore, but they had it.
You know that fashion is cyclical, so it's possible. It's about time for the fanny pack to come back.
Well, if you get one that's like a Louis Vuitton or something, you got to get a designer pack. I think that might be the way to get around it, right?
That's Gucci so or something.
Yeah, there you go. You need some with some bling on it.
Yeah, there. That'll get her done. Get her done. Well, you know, unfortunately, we're not all walking around with our fanny packs on, but we do need to make sure we stay adequately supplied with nutrition. So that's one thing I wanted to talk to you a little bit about today is being at your peak and really tuning yourself in for a show or for a shoot. And the difference in nutrition and training, say, randomly throughout any given month versus closing in on a show. What do you feel are some of the big changes coming into a show?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I got that question about 24 times this weekend with all these guys running around. And you know, my first thing to tell most of the guys is, you know, don't rely on a guru. It's nice to get advice, but you're going to have to figure a lot of this out on your own for yourself based on, not to sound rudimentary, but your activity level, how much training you're actually doing. When you're talking about really bringing the water and the carbohydrate content in when you're looking for a photo shoot, because at the end of the day, if you're already lean, we're assuming that you're lean, the amount of water inside the muscle and the amount of carbohydrate is what's going to make the difference.
Right, but don't sit around at 16% body fat and say you need to drop some water.
No, it's not a water issue at that point, that's for sure.
But I mean, sorry to interrupt you there. Next step, please.
Well, I was going to say, you know, some of the best advice I ever got a long time ago was, you know, if you look good on a day-to-day basis, don't really wiggle the knobs too far because you can screw yourself up. And no, one of the things to really play around with is how much carbohydrate you're taking in. And always remember that, you know, for every gram of carb you're storing as glycogen, you're going to have 2 grams of water. So, you know, you can't cut your water and expect for your muscles to get full, because it'll pull water from other areas, but there's only a limited supply. So some guys stay flat and they're eating carbs because there's not enough water in their system. And so it's something you got to kind of play around with, but you should play around with it before you're going to get ready for the shoot. So you can start to see how you're looking in the weeks coming up to it, or playing around with it before you get that call. So, you know, you can make some slight changes. I mean, eating some dry carbohydrate or some oatmeal or some yams or something like that with less water sometimes just makes all the difference, because you're already kind of there, but you're just trying to pull a little bit of water into the muscle with some carbohydrate, and now all of a sudden you look really crisp. It could be that simple.
I think you're right on with that. You know, keeping it within your normal realm of what you do, and then just making those minor tweaks. And if you really do pay attention, you can, I guess it's smart to record what's going on, so you know, and then you know what to do when you do come up on a shoot or a show, because oftentimes, well, for a shoot, it's very short notice, and for a show, you have more time to prep, but it's good to practice when you don't have any vital shoots or contests coming up.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thing that there's used to be a lot of guys that would thought that there was some witchcraft they could do at the, you know, at the last second. And that's just really not the way to look at it. It's not how you do it. Voodoo and witchcraft don't really work. I mean, there was a time when there was all these different sodium loading and all these carb loading methods, and some can work, but some can be disastrous. And especially if you're a physique guy, you should be really, you should understand where you are at all times, especially when you've done a few practice runs. So when you get that phone call for the shoot, you know, you're just going to make minor adjustments. And you should be pretty close.
Well, and that's it. I mean, again, some of the physique guys, they do like to go through some version of a bulking phase like a traditional bodybuilder, but it seems like the majority of us are sticking in that single-digit body fat, 5-6% year-round. So they're ready for that shoot. And speaking of a guy that is in that kind of shape year round, again, like I said earlier, we have Max Wettstein ready to join us. So after this short commercial break, we're going to bring in Max. This guy's had tons of covers. So you're going to learn a lot from him today.
Fusion Bodybuilding makes bodybuilding's strongest supplements, and they're committed to giving back to you. Fusion Bodybuilding not only want to promote the bodybuilding lifestyle, but they also want to help build the sport. Bodybuilding is all they do. It's their obsession. You know the feeling. That's why you're here. Visit Fusion Bodybuilding at FusionBodybuilding.com or join in on the conversation on the Fusion Bodybuilding fan page on Facebook, where you'll find IFBB Pro Q&As, contest giveaways, and nothing but in-depth bodybuilding talk. Fusion Bodybuilding, bodybuilding's strongest supplements. Head over to FusionBodybuilding.com today. On March 17, 2012, St. Patrick's Day weekend, First Form and Hydrolyze Ultra present the First Form Pro Women's Physique, Fitness, and Bikini Championship, along with the First Form NPC Midwest Bodybuilding Fitness, Figure, Physique, Bikini, and Men's Physique Championship, a national qualifier. This event has so many perks for both athletes and fans alike. Just ask the over 1,300 guests that attended last year's event. Taking place at the St. Louis University Bush Student Center, you'll watch IFBB Pro and future superstar Mike Liberatore and current IFBB Pro superstar Kai Green as they light up the stage with their posing routines. Six-time fitness Olympia Adela Garcia will be in attendance. The top male and female pros and top amateurs from across the country are coming to St. Louis. Plus, the RX Muscle Model Search is taking place. Here's your chance to win some great prizes, get a photo shoot, and also be featured on RXMuscle.com. Come meet the top supplement companies in attendance at their booths with free samples. March 17th, 2012 in St. Louis, Missouri. All contest information can be found at npcmidwest.com, including tickets and prices. Don't miss it. Go to npcmidwest.com for all information. P28 High Protein Bread is the official bread of RX Muscle. Are you looking to incorporate more protein into your meals or just want to enjoy bread again? Then look no further. Try the 100% natural P28 High Protein Bread. P28 High Protein Bread is a formulated revolutionary breakthrough product. Packed with whey protein isolate, 14 grams of protein per slice, 12 grams of carbs, 8 essential amino acids, and made with 100% whole wheat. Fear bread no more. Build a better body with P28. Order today at highproteinbread.com. P28 is also now available at bodybuilding.com and many other retailers. Order now, highproteinbread.com. P28 Bread, RX Muscle approved.
RxMuscle.com. Now you have a place to turn when you want the truth on bodybuilding, diet, and exercise. Up-to-the-minute news and more. Visit the RxMuscle.com forums featuring celebrity Q&As with IFBB professional athletes, top amateurs, and the brightest minds in the industry. Listen to our weekly radio shows, including Heavy Muscle Radio, Muscle Girls Inc., After Hours, and more. Contest coverage, videos, even our own social networking site, RX Muscle Place. Visit RxMuscle.com.
Welcome back to Physique Star Radio. I'm Ian Lauer with Vince Andrich, and joining us now is Max Wettstein. Max, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how are you today? What's on the agenda?
Well, right now I am helping my wife cook dinner, helping my 8-year-old daughter do her homework, feeding the dog, and mixing in this interview and getting the new baby to sleep.
You know, Vince and I were hungry. We were wondering what you're cooking up down there.
Actually, my wife is running the show for the most part. We're having chili with some free-range beef and a lot of vegetables, and it should be good and healthy and also satisfying at the same time.
Nice. Now, Vince, you've seen some of the shots here of Max, and he's in shape basically year-round. I say basically because I'm assuming maybe there's a little slight occasionally, but in shape year-round. That's one of the things we talk about very frequently for physique guys that are looking to get into the business. What are some tips that you have there, Max?
Yeah, to be a successful fitness model, you got to be in shape all year-round because you're getting basically one day's notice for a casting or an audition. And so you kind of have to show up ready. I mean, you may not have your tan dialed in or anything like that, but you're getting, you know, at the most a week's notice, usually one day's notice for the initial casting for the job. And so if you're not dialed in and have your abs going, then you're not going to get the job. You're not going to get looked at or even get a call back.
Well, and it's also important when you do get that call that you show up and you're representative of what people are expecting from your photos.
Yeah, that's a big problem with comp cards. A lot of people's comp cards, including my own, is currently 3 years old. So you want to look like your comp card. So you want to have a recent up-to-date headshot. And also you don't want to have something that's been over Photoshopped to where you just don't look like yourself at all. You want to look like your headshot, and I think that's what you're getting at.
Well, I think that's a great point. I mean, you see some of these profile pictures on Facebook, and then you meet the person in person, and you don't have any idea who the hell they are. And it's like you just were talking to them on Facebook, and you see them in person, you don't even recognize them in comparison to their Photoshop pictures. So, I mean, it's a really good point. Yeah. So, some of our audience may not know some of the work that you've done. So, can you tell us a little bit about some of the different magazines that you've had, and some of the different infomercials you've done?
Yeah, some of my best work is I've had about 12 different men's health covers. Most of those are international. Some of them are books. And then I had a men's fitness magazine cover that was domestic. But I'm currently on the Men's Health Big Book of Exercises. And then I'm also the model inside the Abs Diet books 1 and 2. And, yeah, I've done a bunch of infomercials. And now I've kind of evolved from that and to where I'm not necessarily proud of some of them because they're slightly gimmicky products that I don't fully endorse. And, you know, as a model, you're being booked as a model and a talent, so you're not necessarily endorsing the product. But I've done a whole laundry list of infomercials.
And that's a tricky one, too, and I found myself dealing with that same type of situation. I mean, you're working to book a job, and oftentimes you don't know what you're going in for until you're already there. And then it's like, well, is this a product that you use? And that's a tricky subject.
Yeah, I mean, if you're the talent, it's really just, if you're a professional, it's just another gig. You go in there, you're just a body and a face demonstrating the product, and that doesn't imply that you're endorsing it. I mean, some people might disagree, and that's how I used to look at it, but now I've done so much work, and I feel like my brand is Max Wettstein and use my name, so that becomes a different story. But like you said, when you get that initial casting or audition, you don't even know what the fitness product is half the time. and you may, they may not even have it. The casting director may not even have it. And then you book the job and you go in there and it's some cheesy product and you're like, oh man, this would never work. I would never use this. And then a nightmare might happen where they actually ask you to start saying some lines, but we can debate the morals or ethics behind that. Yeah, you know, meanwhile, though some of those infomercials pay the most of all. Like a cover probably pays anywhere from $200 to $500, whereas an infomercial is going to pay you anywhere from $1,000 to $2,500 for the day. So,
now, if you could repeat those numbers for listeners, because a lot of guys are thinking, if I get a cover of Muscle and Fitness, I'm going to make $20,000. Or if I'm in an infomercial, I'm going to make $40,000. Could you repeat those numbers that you see for real pay?
Well, unfortunately, the fitness side of things has become so bastardized and incestuous, the rates have just totally dropped off because a lot of people aren't using agencies or their agents. But yeah, a cover, usually you book a cover try, so you don't even know if you're going to get it. Then you don't get paid for it unless you do get it, and it's usually anywhere from $200 to $500 for, I'm talking major covers, like my men's health cover was $500. My men's fitness cover was only like $250. And, yeah, the infomercials is what tends to pay the most.
Right.
You'll get usually about $1,000 a day, up to $2,000 a day if you're really lucky. And then if you get, like, a nice campaign where you're endorsing a product, that can pay well because you'll get residuals or royalties.
Now, you used a word a while back, and we've probably we've talked about this on the show before, and this is something that Vince is very familiar with, and that's your brand. So you talk about building your brand as opposed to just being a body. So how do you feel about building a brand and as a person versus say for a product? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think there's really any difference. I think especially in the world we live in now with Facebook and everything else, you are a brand. And the world of getting a job and getting the ring after 20 years, that's over. So you have to promote yourself and your body of work. I think we mentioned it last show. You don't even have to bring your resume anymore. They can look you up. And so you're the sum total of your body of work. And so that's how you have to look at everything. The quality of what you produce and year in, year out. And you can't just be a flash in the pan. And I think Max has obviously got this down. He knows that he's a brand.
Mm-hmm. So Max, you've built your brand, and I know you're represented by a few agencies, one of which we share, Shame and Freitas out of San Diego. So once you have your brand built, how is your communication with your agents now that you're so busy with living the rest of your life? What's different now versus 5 years ago?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think my agents and agencies in general kind of preferred it when I didn't have necessarily a brand and a big ego and all that goes with it. They liked it when you were just a body that would do whatever they told you to do and just showed up with your mouth shut and did what you were supposed to do, what the photographer told you. But, yeah, now with Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and all that, we're all building our own brands, and I do think that's important, and I have done it. Like I mentioned earlier, if I hadn't have already built up a nice working relationship with my agencies over the past 10 years, I don't think I'd get hired now, or I would have been fired, because I am so busy with my daytime job as an airline pilot with my family and coaching my daughter that I don't go to most of the castings and auditions they send me to, and they're really understanding. But that also in a way makes me more exclusive, and so when I do land something, it's usually big or it does pay well, and so I still have a good relationship with them.
That's a good point when you talk about it being more exclusive, because that's something you can run into with the infomercials is, let's say you just worked an ab product and you have another one that's going to come out soon that you shot, you know, a year ago or whatever, and then you're being called in for yet a third. That can be an issue when you have that conflict.
Yeah, unless they had you sign I can't think of the term now, to where you said you wouldn't do any other similar products. Yeah, then it's not an issue. And most of those directors couldn't care less that you just did a similar product like the week before, because they probably have a knockoff sitting right there. And yeah, there's really not a lot of ethics going on there. I mean, like bigger brands like Bowflex, they want to make sure you haven't done anything similar, and they're kind of concerned. And then one of my longest running clients, Hoist Fitness, that makes home gym equipment and commercial gym equipment, for a while they didn't want me working with any of their competitors, but they weren't paying me a retainer, was the word I wanted to say. So eventually I said, listen, I have to do some of these other jobs. I'm missing out on money. And now they've understood. So,
well, that's interesting. I mean, because I have seen on the casting sheets, you know, what have you done in the past? So it's interesting to hear your take on it. And you're right. Yeah, the retainer, if you're not getting a retainer, you have to, I mean, you have another job, but for someone that's trying to make their living solely via fitness, I mean, you have to be able to work unless you are on retainer.
Yeah, and I think some of the bigger, more reputable brands, they worry about what you just did, but all the knockoff products where they're almost violating the patents, they don't care and they don't ask. But I think, like you said, the bigger names like Bowflex comes to mind, they're going to care what you just did.
Right. So,
but yeah, if they're not going to give you a retainer, then they can't expect you not to do any other products that are similar.
What projects do you have coming up in the near future, or what have you shot recently? I mean, I know you said you have a couple things out now, but what should we be looking out for?
Tomorrow I got direct booked with Roadrunner Sports. They're based right here in San Diego. They're a running shoe manufacturer, so that's good. They were actually one of my first clients since like 1999, and I booked them through Shaman Freitas, and it was a direct booking because, you know, we've all had a 10-year relationship, and I really love that kind of thing. And then independently, I'm putting out a new athletic abs DVD, a guide to basically, you know, how to get six-pack abs. It's a holistic health approach and a lifestyle approach. And Chelsea Cruz, I brought her on board as a co-host and to represent female physiology. And then I'm also doing mainstream stuff. I'm really trying, as I transition into my 40s, I'm trying to transition into more mainstream stuff. Like I'm starting to go to commercial auditions for like Chevy trucks and Ford trucks or whatever. I mean, there's no limitations. I did some outdoor clothing and Sports Authority and some REI type of stuff. So no limit.
Yeah, Vince, this goes back to what we were talking about before and the diversity and the kinds of projects. Now, not that Max is a men's physique competitor, but the kind of jobs he goes out for, a lot of these men's physique guys could go out for as well.
Well, that's the point. I think that, the commercial world or the marketing world is always going to be looking for great physiques or bodies. The market for that probably won't ever go away. How you fit into the pecking order is another story, right? I mean, so but
true.
Max obviously has the right idea, is, you know, to stay in shape, keep promoting himself. He's also obviously got a career, but as a pilot, which I was going to ask Max, how did you get involved in the modeling side? Was it the case of you were on the beach and someone discovered you, or that didn't happen?
Well, I was always into playing sports and working out, and I kind of knew that I had a look that might appeal. And then in my last tour of the Navy, I was based in Coronado in San Diego, and I worked out at Frog Fitness, and some guys there were doing some modeling jobs and said, hey, you should try it out. And I got that local agency, Shaman Freitas. They just picked me up out of the blue, and then I did some things like Roadrunner Sports, and then eventually I went to one of those Get Discovered big seminar things up in L.A. where it's just a giant cattle call. It's a way to scam money, but there is actually some agents there, including Mike Lyons from Silver Models in New York, although he wasn't Silver Models at the time, and he basically said, come fly out to New York, and I'll introduce you to Men's Health and all these other people and get you on a beer commercial. And I'm like, yeah, right, whatever. But when I started working for JetBlue, I was out in New York anyway, so I went into Mike Lyons' office, and that same day he introduced me to Men's Health, and it went from there. So I got lucky in a lot of ways, and that's why I credit almost everything to that one agency, even though there's so many guys that do it alone without any kind of agency. And you know, if you're doing it on your own without an agent, you're not going to get things like SAG commercial auditions. You're not going to get sent in to meet with a casting director. But yeah, there's a lot of things you can book outright on your own.
So if you had to break it down, let's say just three tips, one through three for these guys that are working to build a physique and trying to use it to build a career, what would be your top three things to focus on?
I would say first, be really honest with yourself. Take a hard look in the mirror and maybe do some test shoots. Don't pay money. Do some test shoots and get a couple of photos you can work with and show them around and see if you have what it takes. Then move to, maybe see if you get a reaction on Facebook and all that, but then move to either L.A. or New York to where the industry is and try and find an agent. Maybe do things. I know your last guest was Clark Bartram with mm-hmm. Fitness Model International. That's a great place
right.
to start. Also, I think I'm going over past my three tips, but do a show.
You can have
contest.
Four or five if you like. That's fine.
Yeah. Do one of those contests like Muscle Mania or at the Fitness Expo or at the Arnold or, you know, those Muscle Model or Fitness Model contests, because it doesn't matter if you win in the top three, none of that matters. What matters is there's going to be all these magazine scouts there and all these photographers there, and they're always looking for fresh faces, and they'll be your gateway to get into a magazine. Like, you can, I know guys that do those shows, they don't place, but the very next day they book a shooter that next week before they fly home, and next thing you know, those photos are getting in the magazines if they have what it takes. And now they're only going to make like $200, but all of a sudden you have tear sheets for your portfolio.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think that's one of the great things since the NPC brought in the men's physique competition. It gives these guys a chance to get up there and get that kind of exposure. And then if they're smart like you, Max, and they're working on building a brand and they have that support of a YouTube and a blog and so on and so forth, then they can really do something with that exposure.
Yeah, and that gets you into writing and consulting and maybe making a book later or a DVD. And you know, one thing about me is I don't look like a bodybuilder. And in fact, a lot of times I just look skinny to most people when I'm in clothes. They're like, there's no way that was you on the cover. But that also makes me have a more attainable physique, and it also makes me more mainstream to where I can also go out and try these other type of auditions and casting and commercials and not just limit myself to fitness, you know?
Yeah. Well, I know you have a dinner to tend to, a daughter to coach, and a number of things to get back to. So we have to let you go here shortly. But Vince, do you have any more questions for Max while we still have him on the line here?
No, I think congratulations, Max. You're doing a great job in representing the whole fitness community, and just keep it up.
Well, thanks Max, for having me. I really appreciate your time. I enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for joining us on the show, and I look forward to seeing your projects coming out, and hopefully we'll have you back on again soon.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you for joining us here at Physique Star Radio. Stay tuned. Shortly after this commercial break, we'll have Dave Palumbo and Dr. Conley.
Now, it's time for Muscle University Radio with Dave Palumbo and Dr. Scott Connolly.
Welcome to another edition of Muscle University. I'm Dave Palumbo, and I'm here with Dr. Scott Conley, the owner and inventor of Myotropics Physique Nutrition. Scott, we're back again this week, and I got to tell you, we've been getting a lot of questions in the mailbag, and one of the questions that a lot of people have been asking about is there's so many different types of creatine on the market. I remember back in the early 90s when you and I first got into this whole game, there was really just creatine monohydrate, and it just came out, and everyone seemed to use it, and they got good results from it. And now you have creatine serums, you have creatine ethyl esters, you got everything, you know, that you could possibly think in the bag of tricks, so to speak. And everyone thinks that their form of creatine is superior to the original. What's your take on this whole topic?
Well, you know, the reality is, Dave, that from the standpoint of what is actually factually known and been authenticated in the scientific literature, is that, you know, number one, creatine monohydrate, which is obviously the oldest form that this particular product has been available on the market as, is highly effective from the standpoint of what we know it does with respect to the phosphagen, you know, energy status of the cell. We know that creatine monohydrate itself is exceptionally stable product. It's an amphilytic amino acid, so as such, its solubility is frankly terrible. But, you know, again, its stability over time in an anhydrous powdered form is exceptional. It shows no degradation, even in extremes of temperature. It's cheap as dirt, and it works. I think the response in terms of the marketplace to alternate forms has been largely market-driven.
And explain that a little bit, you know, because people don't understand that there's marketing, you know, tools that people use to help sell their products better and use cheaper products a lot of times to do that.
Sure. I mean, you know, this particular product has, you know, proven efficacy, and it basically, like I said, is so ubiquitous in terms of supply that its price point has been progressively dropping, you know, since its introduction in the 90s. As such, being such a popular product with a fairly hefty share of the $2.7 billion estimated sports nutrition market, obviously there's a great deal of financial animus on the part of manufacturers to introduce, you know, a better mousetrap. And that, I think, has been a large driving force behind the introduction of novel forms of creatine.
You know, it's interesting because it seems like supplements have like a, almost like, and I equate supplements to ties, you know, like sometimes the wide ties are in style, sometimes the skinny ties are in style. It seems like creatine kind of lost its sexiness in our current day and age we're in now, whereas it was in the 90s, it was like the hottest thing going. And then it had a little resurgence, I think, probably in the early 2000s. But I think it just lost its sex appeal now. Everything seems to be pre-workout stuff where people throw a cocktail of 100 different ingredients in.
Well, again, if you have a commodity ingredient that has essentially met the bar, so to speak, with respect to efficacy, and it has remained a sort of stable component of the marketplace for the number of years that creatine has been around now. This thing was introduced back in the mid-90s and has, you know, stayed around as a major performer in terms of sales ever since then. You're right. Its appeal as a sort of sexy compound is non-existent now. It's sort of a staple supplement for someone who is interested in supplementing natural products that have proven efficacy with respect to the acquisition of strength and muscle mass. So a large part of the market force to develop, as I said, again, a sexier, better mousetrap has been behind the development of a lot of different products. I mean, historically over time, we started off with, you know, creatine anhydrous and then creatine monohydrate. And as you mentioned, now we have creatine ethyl ester and creatine malate, creatine methyl ester, creatine citrate, creatine malate, creatine pyruvate, creatine alpha aminobutyrate, creatine alpha ketoglutarate, serum creatinine phosphate, creatinine taurinate, creatinine pyroglutamate, you know, ketoisocoprolate, creatinine ketoisocoprolate, creatinine orotate, carnitine creatinate, and creatine decanoate, and creatine gluconate. Those are the ones that sound like steroidal linkages.
They got linked
well
to them
again. There. That's part of the allure in terms of the marketing hype. Is you have something that's called, you know, for example, creatine pyroglutamate or creatine ketoisocoprolate. That sounds a lot sexier than creatine monohydrate.
Right.
And obviously a compound like creatine decanoate obviously skews into the, you know, suggestion that it's sort of a steroidal type compound.
Right.
But in fact, the listener needs to understand that at the end of the day, there's only really one thing that matters in terms of your purchase of any of these products, and that is their performance for you. So the issues that have been touted to affect performance at the end of the day, and again, performance for our listeners is, you know, how strong and how big am I, is, you know, related to a lot of variables that have been touted as being differentially affected by the various forms. So we're talking about stability, solubility, penetration into muscle tissue, or the bioavailability issue, and basically at the end of the day, for, you know, absolute performance benefits have been appended to the marketing claims. So the issue for a consumer is to examine sort of stepwise whether these concerns for solubility, stability, bioavailability are really differentially addressed by the different forms that are on the market.
Now, do any of these these other forms of creatine work? I mean, from the lab results and the data that you've seen?
Well, there are various physicochemical attributes of creatine because of its chemical nature that do impact things like solubility. For example, creatine salts such as citrate, malate, fumarate, tartrate, pyruvate, ascorbate, orotate, etc., which were first, you know, introduced as competition to the basic creatine monohydrate in the late 1990s, you know, may exhibit enhanced solubility because of the nature of the, again, the physicochemical properties of creatine monohydrate in solution revolve around the molecular structure of that compound and the molecular structure's interaction with the pH of the solution and the temperature of the solution. So with respect to that particular variable, solubility, you could show, for example, that creatine pyruvate is more soluble than creatine monohydrate. The question is, so what? At the end of the day, the solubility is of very little interest because even in the case of a salt, the stability of the salt at a temperature that's consistent with storage in a retail location is lousy. And that's an underwriting facet of the chemistry of creatine monohydrate, is that its stability in aqueous media is terrible. And basically that forces a consumer to the conclusion that if you're going to mix creatine in any way, shape, or fashion in a water solution and expect to take it, you know, some time interval after you mix it, you better put it in a refrigerator.
Gotcha, because it'll break down, otherwise.
It sits at room temperature, it's going to be degraded pretty quickly. Now, you know, the various aspects of, again, the pH and so forth can affect the rate at which that breaks down. But from the standpoint of, you know, a practical shelf-stable product that could be offered in aqueous solution, you know, really no one has shown that that is commercially at the present time. So the issue is, if solubility, for example, you know, is differential in terms of a salt versus, you know, the creatine monohydrate, which is more of a base type compound, not an acid type compound, then your next question is, well, okay, it's, so it's more soluble, but what does that really get me? I can't, you know, if I'm a store, I'm a commercial nutrition supplier, I can't keep it on the shelf. If I'm a consumer, yeah, it's more soluble, but I still have to, you know, swig the stuff down pretty quickly or it's going to degrade. So at the end of the day, is the solubility influential in terms of the bioavailability? In other words, if you measure the plasma enrichment of the compound, and by the way, the notion that, you know, the stability in plasma is differentially affected is largely, you know, been a commercial, actually it's a lie, if you want to know the truth.
Explain what you're talking about when you say that.
In particular, the creatine ethyl ester type stuff has, you know, addressed this issue that, you know, it's more stable and doesn't break down in your digestive system. And the fact of the matter is that's not true. The creatine ethyl ester promotes the generation of creatinine faster than creatine monohydrate by a large measure.
Wow.
And it is not more stable in passage through the stomach and intestines and into the blood than creatine monohydrate. And in fact, where there have been studies over time looking at various aspects of the total spectrum of effectiveness, for example, stability, solubility, plasma enrichment, and then at the end of the day, performance, how much muscle, how much, you know, strength increase do you get when creatine monohydrate and creatine ethyl ester have been compared head to head? Willoughby's group did that some time ago. The creatine monohydrate was vastly superior to the creatine ethyl ester. And in fact, one recent paper suggests that people who buy into this ethyl ester stuff and various forms of that can have elevations in serum creatinine that can lead physicians to believe that the person there whose lab results are looking at is in renal failure.
Wow.
So, you know, it's not a great idea to believe this nonsense without really looking objectively at the substantiation of the claims.
Right.
As I said, right now, from the standpoint of a you know, sort of a realistic consumer view of the creatine world, there is no evidence to suggest that any of these forms, albeit, you know, different in some aspects of the creatine's solubility or whatever, at the end of the day, do they really give you anything differential in terms of performance? And my view or perspective now is the answer to that is no. There have been some studies with the addition of additional nutrients. As you probably know, that years ago, the demonstration that there is a specific creatine transporter that, you know, facilitates the transport of creatine from the plasma into the muscle tissue is facilitated by an insulinotropic or insulin-releasing compound like a carbohydrate,
right,
or higher doses of protein could facilitate higher tissue retention levels, which, you know, there is some evidence that that is true. But at the end of the day, again, if it translates into higher tissue levels, is that significant in terms of the absolute performance variable increase that you get? And so far, no one has shown that.
Well, that was the old Bill Phillips marketing scheme: add some sugar into the creatine monohydrate, you know, and drink it down. You know,
again, people have to understand that this is a stepwise evaluation. Is it soluble? Yes. No. How soluble? Who cares? You get it into your stomach. It's relatively stable in your stomach because of the acid environment. And in essence, it stays relatively stable throughout transit, throughout the digestive system. So a large measure of what you take in gets into your body, gets into the bloodstream.
Let me just stop you for a second, because I always thought the stomach acids were very detrimental to the creatine monohydrate.
Well, the stomach pH is of a pH range that is not detrimental. It's true that the stability is degraded as pH goes up, unless you get into very high ranges. The extremes of stability are affected by very unphysiologic ranges of pH change. So the stomach pH is actually in a range that will degrade will reduce the degradation of creatinine. A very high.
Well, Scott, what I'm thinking is that the stomach acids, because the pH is so low, you would think you would not want to take the creatine with anything that's going to elicit more of a hydrochloric acid release, like a protein type of a supplement, right? Would that be
true within that context of what's realistic physiologically? A very high pH, for example, a very basic pH, mm-hmm, results in what's called a deprotonation. You remove a hydrogen ion off of the acid group of the creatinine molecule, thereby slowing down the degradation process by making it much more difficult for the molecule to what's called cyclization. It basically, you know, the position and protection of certain atomic groups on the molecule either accelerate or retard its tendency for what is called intramolecular cyclization. And that's the process that determines degradation. So the degradation of creatine can be reduced or even halted, stopped altogether, mm-hmm, by either lowering the pH to under 2.5 or increasing the pH. As I just said, a very high pH produces a change which allows the deprotonation of the acid group. A very low pH results in the protonation or contribution of a hydrogen atom to the amide function of the creatine molecule, which in effect prevents the intramolecularization in a different way. But the net effect of very low pH or a very high pH is to affect the cyclization of the molecule, which directly impacts its degradation.
So it'll actually be more stable, Scott? Scott, it'll be more stable in both a low pH and the high pH?
Yeah. This effect also occurs under the acidic conditions in the stomach, hence preventing the breakdown of creatine.
Interesting.
The conversion of creatine to creatinine in the gastrointestinal tract is minimal, regardless of how long it sticks around. So if you have a very slow transit time, the conversion from creatinine from creatine to creatinine in the human GI tract is very, very, very small. So, and again, the stability in the stomach is actually attributable to the acidic conditions in the stomach.
In your estimation, are there ways to increase the solubility of the creatine monohydrate powder?
Yes, you can make it into a salt. Now, several salts exist, but the problem is, again, some creatine salts appear to be less stable when compared with the parent compound, creatine monohydrate. For example, tricreatine citrate results in creatinine levels of around 800 parts per million at physiologic temperature or room temperature after about a month of storage. Mm-hmm. And so it's true that the salts are, more soluble, but again, more soluble does not mean more stable.
Okay, they try to say, inside the muscle cell, obviously the creatine monohydrate gets converted to creatine phosphate, which is obviously the compound that will help regenerate ATP in the muscle. For a while, they were selling, I noticed there's a couple companies that were putting creatine phosphate into their supplements, saying that it solubilizes very easily in water. The problem is that, from what I understand at least, that the creatine phosphate cannot be absorbed into the cell. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. So you want the creatine by itself to get transported as creatine into the muscle cell. And that's facilitated by the existence of a specific transporter. And many people confuse it that it's the same as the glucose transporter. It is not. It is a very specific transporter. It is facilitated by, an insulin co-stimulation, but it is not insulin receptor substrate pathway. It's a different entry point into the cell, different doorway. It is specifically transported. It's an actively transported substance across a concentration gradient. And one of the interesting things is, people have yet to fully explain why a portion of the population is relatively resistant to the effect of this stuff, this so-called non-responder group.
Right. What do you think?
Which was originally identified by Greenwood several years ago. And there have been various explanations as to why, some people are relatively unresponsive to typical loading doses of this stuff. The initial supposition was that everybody's initial saturation level was different because of the existing amount of creatine. That kind of hasn't been borne out. Other people have posited that it's differential, the differential lies in the transporter functionality, and hence the notion that if you combine creatine with carbohydrate or protein, that you will overcome that and get more into the cell. And there is evidence that in fact occurs with carbohydrate, with protein. Some people have used a substance known as the dextrorotary form of pinitol. You may have heard of that. Mm-hmm. The D-pinitol combination with creatine. There is literature in humans to suggest that combining D-pinitol and creatine ingestion will facilitate a greater uptake into the muscle. And I don't think that has been explored yet with respect to mitigating the non-responder issue. Some people, I think, have made assumptions that's true without actually bothering to prove it.
What do you think? What's your take? You have good instincts regards this. What do you think it is that why some people do not respond to creatine?
Well, I think probably it has something to do with the transport functionality, quite frankly. I mean, it obviously, you could posit that individuals who, for example, are vegetarians would have essentially very low creatine stores because of their lack of intake of meat and fish, which are the highest concentration food sources of it. But there haven't been enough people studied, and the variability between individuals is so great that there isn't really a consistent answer to that. Just makes sense to me that because of the variability in transporter function in other instances, that might be a likely source of the differential, is the actual transport functionality. And it therefore may make sense for people who seemingly have no response to it, if they're just taking creatine monohydrate, for example, to try to take it with a carbohydrate or a protein source. Okay. Either one will work because both are sufficiently insulinotropic, or they release enough insulin to accomplish this, you know, accentuated accumulation intracellularly.
Last question, Scott, before we wrap this up. How much insulin do you need? I mean, I see some of these supplements out there, and I'm not going to mention names because I don't want to, you know, I don't want anyone getting any phone calls from anyone, but some of these contain 90, 100 grams of sugar, like, you know, mixed with a, you know, 5 gram dose of creatine monohydrate. Is that too much?
Yeah. you basically need, you know, very little amount of, you know, simple dextrose type thing, you know. You know, under 20 grams will do the trick for everybody. And that's something that, you know, again, has been overstated grossly in the sort of commercial literature about this.
What about just a whey isolate? I mean, like for a guy who's dieting on very low carbs, would a whey isolate be enough to mix with your creatine?
Yes.
Okay. So you need a very small insulin response.
A whey protein, again, containing a healthy dose of the insulinotropic, you know, branched chain amino acids would produce a sufficient bump in physiologic insulin to facilitate this.
Yeah, I think that that's an important point because I think people do think that they need to take exorbitant amounts of some kind of a sugar in with this stuff, and that's just not the case, and it winds up making people fat rather than more muscular.
Yeah, the original literature used doses of carbohydrate between 50 and 100 grams and 50 grams of protein, both of which are excessive.
That's what I think, too. I agree with you on that. And once again, we've been enlightened to the world of creatine monohydrate by Dr. Connolly. We're at the end of our edition here of Muscle University. We'll see you next week.
This has been another episode of Physique Star Radio, exclusively on RxMuscle.com. Be sure to visit Myotropics.com for the most innovative physique nutrition supplements available today.